One, two, three, four, five, six. They're all here. And I know that some people commented that they liked my animation during the unscripted portion of my sermon last time, and I appreciate your encouragement. However, I doubt that I could reproduce the excitement prompted by that panic-induced state. Now, I just don't want you to get your hopes up, but I am taking your encouragement to heart for future messages, so. The psalmist asked in today's reading, what is man that you should be mindful of him? Indeed, what is man? What does it mean to be human? What distinguishes humans from animals? Are humans basically good or evil? How necessary is freedom, love, truth, virtue, and meaning to being fully human? Or what does fully human even mean? What is the purpose of human existence? Although these questions have confounded man for most of history, the rapid advance of technology has added new layers of confusion. Now, by technology, I just simply mean that I refer to anything that is discovered or created that harnesses nature and its laws for man's use. Technology in itself is neither good nor evil. It is simply a mechanism for interacting with the physical world. Most technologies have the potential to benefit humanity or to harm it. Think of the development of nuclear energy, which provides heat and electricity for homes, while at the same time being used in nuclear weapons of mass destruction. And we could repeat that. Almost any technology you think of has both that positive and negative potential. More recent technologies, such as the personal computer, the internet, smartphones, robotics, and artificial intelligence, have introduced a multitude of questions and concerns about their effects on our humanness and human societies. Silicon Valley is introducing these new technologies at breakneck speed, and we tend to adopt them with little or no discernment or skepticism until after the negative effects are rooted in our way of thinking and living in the world. Now, many professionals, such as sociologists, economists, psychologists, and medical doctors, are examining these technologies and their effects on human living. Studies are beginning to identify correlations between their use and social and psychological disorders. Some of these include weakened human interactions, increased self-image issues, fractured and polarized communities, a spreading loneliness, and an overall impoverishment of human experience, to name just a few. The companies that produce these technologies often turn a deaf ear to these studies and market their products with increasing speed. Many times, they will acknowledge the studies, and indicate that they are working to minimize or even eliminate the adverse effects of these technologies. For example, a few weeks ago, Mark Zuckerberg was being interviewed about the future of social media technology. And he was asked about the escalating crisis in loneliness, in which great numbers of people are feeling isolated and disconnected more than ever before. And so he told the interviewer, "Well, we are now using AI to devise friend chatbots to help with the loneliness epidemic."
Ooh.
Can't Zuckerberg even see that there might be something wrong with trying to solve a problem created by technology with another technology? Why do I bring all this up? Well, I'm glad you asked that. In the last few months, I've had this kind of convergence of thought. I've been thinking a lot about the nature of man and just the incredible glory and majesty that belongs to us as humans, simply because we were created in the image of God. And secondly, I've been thinking a great deal about the technologies, particularly artificial intelligence, and their effects they're having. I see it at school as a teacher all the time with the smartphones and how the damage that's taking place. My wife and I were at Wildberry just a few months ago, sat down to eat. Two ladies came in, sat right next to us, very close in proximity, of course, because Wildberry's packed. And so I couldn't help but notice they immediately brought out their phones and started texting and scrolling and doing everything else rather than conversing. And it was just like, these things are really striking me as a major defect in what's happening in human experience today. And I believe that the first three chapters of Genesis provide an important infrastructure for understanding who we are and how to exist in the created order. Now, this task is not an easy one, since these chapters often generate more questions than we have answers. The first few verses alone have spawned dozens of interpretations, resulting in some fairly hostile conflicts. An array of questions arises at the outset of the simple reading of this chapter one. For example, who is narrating the story? How did the narrator come to know about these events, since he or she could not have possibly been present when they occurred? How can we even know how it was transmitted, since this is ancient history? Why should we believe in this account of creation rather than one of many other accounts? What relationship does God actually have to the transmission of this story through the millennia? Now, please don't misunderstand what I'm trying to say here. I'm not saying that we cannot know anything with any certainty from these early chapters of the Bible. Yes, questions can indeed lead to uncertainty, but they can also lead to truth. And there are many people who are devoting their lives to finding the answers to these questions, hoping that they can help us discover the God and his wisdom in this biblical text. And I hope that we can find some of that wisdom this morning just to help us navigate the technologies, the technological swamp that we encounter every day. First, let's note that Genesis is not really trying to answer all these questions. That's what we should take note of. First of all, it's not trying to answer all the questions we come up with. For one thing, God is there in the first verse without any reference to where he came from or even who he is. In the beginning, when God created, assumes the existence of the Creator God. Bill Arnold, author of Encountering the Book of Genesis, notes that ancient peoples were very interested in the origin of their gods. By contrast, Israel never tried to explain the origins of God. God always has been, and before he created, he was alone. This was a radical and new concept in ancient Near East. Now, the first 6 days of this creation story that Julie had to get through, this long passage that she got to read today, there is a distinct pattern of each of those days, days in quotes, because we are not sure what a day even means. There's an introduction, and God said. Secondly, there's a command, let there be. Thirdly, there's a report, and it was so. Fourthly, there was an evaluation, and God saw that it was good. Fifth, there was a time sequence, and there was evening and there was morning. This pattern has some slight variations, which may or may not be important to the message of the story. Humans are created on the sixth day, with every indication that they were the climactic point of all creation. Regardless of whether you hold a literal six-day creation, a day-age theory of creation, an evolutionary creation, or some other explanation that hasn't even been thought of yet, humans occupy a place in the universe that is unmatched by any other form of matter. And what distinguishes us from all other forms of creation is that humans were created after a pattern. We bear the very image of God the Creator. The image of God means that man is God-like, but not equal to God. Humans possess many of the characteristics of God that other creatures do not, such as speech, reason, freedom of action and choice, contemplation, judgment, understanding, and care. Now, it seems like the study of genetics has sometimes aimed at diminishing the value of being a human. Most of you have already heard that humans and chimpanzees share 98.8% of their DNA. What you might not know is that humans share 98% of their DNA with pigs. Which is kind of nice because pigs are considered one of the more intelligent mammals. So I wouldn't try to tell one of your children or grandchildren, wow, you're as smart as a pig. You know, I don't know that that's going to fly, but even slugs share 70% of human DNA. Now, at a material level, we may be closely related to other creatures. We can't deny that. But no other creature comes close to the distinction of being an image bearer of God. We've got to keep reminding ourselves of this reality. It is worth noting that the image of God extends to both males and females. Now, this stands in contrast to a patriarchal mindset throughout history that views men as superior to women. And every one of us in this room have been infected with that mindset at some point or other. The Genesis creation account gives equal value to the sexes and shared responsibility in the assignment to have dominion over creation together. This does not ignore distinctions between the genders, one obvious one being the ability of women to bear children. There could be a whole series of sermons I could do easily on this very subject. Hundreds of books on the topic fill bookshelves. But I don't have time to say anything more about it this morning. Sorry, ladies. Oh, I will say one more thing. Let me just say this. Women should not have to fight for their image-bearing position in creation. Men should readily honor it. God's image-bearers were given a job at creation, to fill the earth and subdue it, having dominion over every living thing that moves upon the earth. The word for dominion simply means to rule like a king over his people. The character or nature of that rule is not implied in the word. It can be harsh or benevolent. In Genesis, it simply means that humans, like God, have a capacity to rule and are given the authority to make decisions for all of the creation that can turn out for the good or the harm of that creation. In his image, we stand as God's representatives in and over the created order. This implies that we should rule like God, with wisdom, love, and a view to what is good and brings flourishing to all of creation, not to just what is good for us as human creatures. The word subdue offers more insight into this rule. It implies that creation will not be a willing participant in man's rule, but humans will have to exert effort to cause the creation to get into a form that is beautiful and or useful to man and to itself. Farmers know this truth all too well. I'm reading a book right now that's set in the 1100s, and it's a 970-page book that is taking me forever to get through. But it's interesting how when there is, you know, just a bad growing season, or two growing seasons, or a storm that destroys the crops, in just 2 or 3 years, how the entire economy is upset and people are starving to death because the creation is resisting man's rule and authority over it. And it takes a great deal of wisdom to manage those situations so that that doesn't happen. Anyone who has ever tried to rule over a garden or subdue the weeds in the lawn, we understand this truth. Creation is not cooperative to our rule. And this has been one of the major deficiencies of technology throughout history. Man strives to exercise a form of control and mastery of the earth that disregards the care and protection that he has been assigned to give to it. Most of you have heard of René Descartes, a 17th century philosopher and scientist. And it's interesting that he wrote, "As soon as I had acquired some general notions concerning physics, they caused me to see that it is possible to attain knowledge which is very useful in life, and thus render ourselves as masters and possessors of nature." Just as there's a vast difference between knowledge and wisdom, there is a chasm between being masters and possessors of nature and subduing the earth with godlike authority. Christian sociologist Craig Gay comments, "It is precisely our skill, our mastery of this technological way of being in the world that has impoverished us in this other way. It has left us not knowing who we are or where we are and how we ought to live. This is the consequence of ignoring humanity's glorious nature as image bearers of the sovereign God and striving to control creation for the human benefit exclusively. It leaves us adrift, powerless and rudderless in a sea of chaos." There's one more aspect of this story that I would like to consider today, and that's the evaluation phase of each part of creation. And God saw that it was good. Once God completes the construction of the cosmos by creating creatures like himself, placing the image bearers in a position to rule over the creation, the narrator tells us God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. Now, we have to be careful how we interpret the meaning of the word good, okay? Dictionary.com lists 42 different meanings for this one word. Now, most commentators would agree that it does not refer to the moral character of the creation, good versus evil. That's not what it's getting at. Again, quoting from Bill Arnold, good carries the sense of approval and acceptance, as it should be, without flaws or blemishes. God is pleased with it. In his book, A Church Called Tov, Scott McKnight explains, Tov, which is the Hebrew word for good, and which is the Hebrew word used here in Genesis 1, Tov is God's design for all creation. He shapes everything for goodness. His turning of the formless and empty into a created order gave everything he created a design, a purpose, a function. Tov is God's artistic evaluation of all he did. In other words, perfect, excellent, just as he wanted it. God was highly pleased with his creation because every molecule of it was in its proper place and was acting according to its design. Its beauty was stunning. Its functionality, flawless. Its order in perfect harmony. The only unknown, the independent variable, if you will, for those of us who are mathies, the only independent variable among this majestic collection of organisms was the human. For in creating them in his own image, God had bestowed the male and female with a freedom of will to choose and act according to their divine-like reason. There is nothing in this story to suggest that they were pre-programmed or predestined to act according to some transcendent script. Leon Cass, who's a bioethicist and a professor at the University of Chicago, has commented, "At the peak of creation stands man, the one godlike creature, alone capable, thanks to his reason, of recognizing the distinctive, articulated order of things. But as we learn in Genesis 2, man is also the creature. Again, thanks to his reason and freedom, who is most capable of disturbing and destroying order, especially as pride in his own powers distorts his perception of the world." Unfortunately, we learn in chapter 3 of Genesis that the man and the woman exercised their freedom in a defiance of God's command. And the harmonious order of God's perfect creation began to unravel. In chapter 4, we witness the first murder. By chapter 6, the human rebellion was so widespread that God exercises a form of judgment on the entire race, but not without extending his grace and forgiveness to one family. Human history has been the tragic effects of human will insubordinate to the will of the Creator. But this is not the whole story. In fact, we learn that there is a bigger story in which creation and fall of the image bearers of God only introduces us to the setting and the conflict that must be resolved by the protagonist. The hero of the story is not introduced until the Gospels. And the climax of this drama occurs when he is crucified and rises from the grave. The central theme of this narrative is the relentless love of God that prompts him to exercise a limitless grace toward his rebellious creatures. This story of redemption surpasses the glory of the creation itself. And the story of redemption is moving towards its final chapter of restoration, when God creates, once again, a new heaven and earth where redeemed humanity can flourish. In the intervening time between redemption and restoration, we are left to determine the character of our sojourn as image bearers of God called to have dominion over the creation. And if we are to thrive in our humanity, we must be vigilant to subdue our technologies so that they really do serve the common good of all of creation. We must examine every human invention with God-informed wisdom, purging anything that erodes our relationship with God and with one another. As we exercise our God-given freedom, we should measure everything by the love of God that inspired our creation and our redemption. Because it's only in this setting that we will enjoy the fullness of our God-intended humanness.